All right, new units. Today we're going to look at control of gene expression. And we're going to look at this in both prokaryotes and eukaryotes, which differ, of course. I mean, you'd expect them to differ in the way that they control their genomes because they're fundamentally different. We'll start with control of prokaryotic gene expression. And what is gene expression, by the way? It's what? Yeah, if we're assuming that they are protein-coding genes, it's synthesis of a protein, but that includes transcription and translation, right? That's what gene expression really refers to. When a gene is expressed, that means it gets transcribed. Not all genes are transcribed in any given cell at any given moment, right? Now, there are some genes that are always turned on. When we say a gene is turned on, that means it's being expressed. It's transcribable. It's accessible to the enzymes that we talked about necessary for transcription. And what word do we give to a gene that's always turned on? Any idea? Constitutive. A gene is constitutive if it's not actually regulated, meaning that it's just always on. Now, this is the minority of genes. Certain genes that code for proteins that the cell always needs, for instance, the enzymes that are involved in glycolysis, which are always needed, or the genes for ribosomes, always needed. So those are constitutive genes. There are some. The vast majority of genes, though, in any given cell, whether it's prokaryotic or eukaryotic, are regulated, meaning they get turned on sometimes, they get turned off sometimes. That's what we really care about, not the constitutive genes here. We want to look at the regulated genes. And in this opening slide, we're looking at the situation for a bacterial cell that is going to use lactose as an energy source. Now, what is lactose? It's not a polysaccharide. It is a sugar, but what specific kind of sugar? What kind of saccharide? It's a disaccharide consisting of what? Of what? Galactose and glucose, correct. So lactose can be used as an energy source for a bacterium, but only if the cell first breaks it down into its two constituent monosaccharides, glucose and galactose, right? What you see here. Well, lactose is entirely useless to a bacterium as a fuel source unless it can first get the lactose into its cell. And that's what the plasma membrane being stylized as an orange bar here is indicating. First of all, the bacterium has to import lactose into its cell, has to get it through the plasma membrane. And doing so requires a protein, specifically an enzyme, galactoside permease. All right? That will allow the lactose to come into the cell. Once it's in the cell, lactose can be used as energy, but indirectly. What's directly used as energy is galactose and glucose, the monosaccharides from which it is made. Therefore, using lactose for energy first requires breaking that lactose into its constituent monosaccharides. And that requires beta-galactosidase. What do we otherwise know that as? Lactase, right. The ones that are taking the lab should know that at least. So this is a second protein that's required if you're going to use lactose as an energy source. You need galactoside permease to get the thing into the cell. You need beta-galactosidase to break it into individual monosaccharides. The point here is that you either need both of these proteins, these enzymes, at the same time, or you don't need either of them. Because if there isn't any lactose available in the environment, then galactoside permease is doing you no good, right? There isn't any lactose to import, so you don't need that one. And if there is no lactose to import, you of course don't need the enzyme that breaks it down into the monosaccharides. So these two proteins are used at the same time. They're either both not used, or not required, that is, or they're both required at the same time. And therefore it makes sense for the genes for which the genes that code for these two proteins to be controlled at the same time, together. And that's what happens often in prokaryotic cells. In slide 2, we can see this arrangement that allows for multiple genes to be simultaneously regulated. Not only simultaneously regulated, regulated all together as a multi-gene unit. And this multi-gene unit is called an operon. Now, operons are common in prokaryotic cells, like I said. They have been discovered in eukaryotic cells as well, but they're not all that common in eukaryotic cells. So we're really talking about what happens in bacteria specifically. This is what these have been studied in. And this was the first operon to be discovered and named an operon. This is the so-called lac operon, lac standing for lactose. All right? Now, there's many different operons. This is just an example of one. But an operon is a stretch of DNA containing multiple genes that share upstream of those genes a promoter. Now, we've already talked about promoters and genes, right? The promoter is where the RNA polymerase is able to bind in order for transcription to occur. And so we learned about promoters on one promoter per gene basis, which does happen for many genes. But in an operon, you have one promoter, and several genes, and therefore, when this operon gets transcribed, you end up transcribing the RNA, the messenger RNA, for several different genes, however many genes are in the operon. And this is the way that the cell ends up either making all of the proteins corresponding to the genes in the operon at once, or making none of them, which makes sense because the genes aren't just random in an operon. The genes are related to each other. They all are contributors to some common goal, like the use of lactose as fuel. All right? So notice that one of these genes in the lac operon codes for beta-galactosidase, the thing that you need to break the lactose into glucose and galactose. It also codes for galactoside permease, which is the one that allows you to get it into yourself. So a transacetylase, one that is also important in the overall pathway of metabolizing lactose. So all three of these are needed at once, or none of them is needed. Therefore, it makes sense to coordinately regulate them as an operon. Now, operons in general can be classified as either inducible or repressible. Okay, now, an inducible operon is an operon that is normally off, meaning it's normally not transcribed, and under the right conditions can be turned on or induced. All right? So, in electrical switches can be normally off or normally on type. A normally off switch means that you have to switch it on in order to for it to work. A normally on switch is you have to switch it off in order for the switch to work. That's the way these operons are as well. So a normally off operon is inducible. Otherwise, it would always be off, which would mean it would be totally worthless, right? On the other hand, a repressible operon is normally on, normally does get transcribed, but under the right conditions can be turned off or repressed. Now, the repression or the induction of an operon occurs because of proteins binding to a part of the operon that actually overlaps the promoter usually, or is very, very close to the promoter in any case. And that region of DNA is called the operator. So an operator is just like all of these parts of the DNA, a stretch of nucleotides, DNA nucleotides. But those DNA nucleotides can be bound temporarily by a protein of some sort, or even a group of proteins. And those proteins are either repressors or inducers, depending on whether they turn the operon on or turn it off. Okay? Well, a protein that either induces or represses an operon, which would be called either an inducer or a repressor protein, is a protein, of course, right? And therefore, it's coded for by its own gene, its own protein-coding gene somewhere in the genome. But that gene, the gene that codes for either the inducer or the repressor, is not part of the operon. It's a separate gene. In the specific example we're looking at, this is the lac operon. This is an inducible operon, which means it's normally off, but can get turned on by an inducer protein binding to the operator of the operon. Okay? But the gene that codes for the repressor protein here, that is not part of this operon. This is a regulatory gene, as it's called, because its product regulates the operon. Okay? Now, I said this is an inducible operon, right, which means it's normally off. The repressor protein is called a repressor protein because it keeps this thing off. And the repressor protein, which is the gene product of this regulatory gene that's not part of the operon, but just happens to be right next to it. It could be anywhere else in the genome, by the way. It just happens to be right by the operon in this example. But you see that the regulatory gene doesn't have to be near the operon. It just needs to code for a protein that regulates the operon. Everyone clear on that? Well, this is a repressor protein, which means when it binds to the operator, it keeps this thing from being transcribed, which is why it makes sense where the operator is. The repressor binding there will keep RNA polymerase from getting from the promoter and proceeding down the operon and transcribing the DNA into messenger RNA. Well, that repressor protein is able to interact with the DNA, we're on slide 3 now, in its normal form, its normal unbound form. You can see that happening on the top here. The repressor protein is produced simply because this LacI gene, which is not part of the lac operon, it's the regulatory gene, makes messenger RNA, which then gets translated into this repressor protein. This repressor protein, when it's just by itself, not bound to anything else, is able to go to the lac operon's operator and bind to that sequence of DNA. And that keeps the operon off. Okay, this is why it is a normally off and therefore inducible operon. And this is appropriate under conditions in which there's no lactose available. Because if you don't have lactose available, why would you spend energy producing the proteins that are required to process that lactose? Proteins are expensive to build, right? As we've talked about in translation. Transcription and translation are both expensive. So don't go through with that if you don't have any lactose to use those enzymes for. This is what keeps the operon off. On the bottom, though, we can see that this inducible operon can be induced into being transcribed. In this case, it's induced into being transcribed because the repressor that's keeping it off can be disallowed from binding to that operator of the operon. All right? It's able to bind to the operator and therefore prevent transcription when it has the correct shape to do that, to interfere with the DNA. So all you need is a different molecule to allosterically bind to that repressor molecule to change its shape into one that no longer is able to bind to the DNA's operator. And therefore, it will no longer keep the operon off. If you keep it from being off, that's really turning it on, right? So that's what L here is doing. L is acting as a ligand that binds allosterically to the repressor protein, changing its shape so that it no longer can repress the lac operon. And therefore, the lac operon gets transcribed, and all three of those genes get built. All three of those proteins get built. So when would you want that to happen if you were a bacterium? When lactose is present, correct? That's when you would want to bother spending the energy to build the proteins that are required to process the lactose. So in this example, but also typically for inducible operons, the thing that actually allows the operon to be turned on is either the thing itself that needs to be processed, like lactose, or something that is present only if lactose is present. In this case, it's actually allolactose. Lactose can get turned into allolactose, which then actually binds to the repressor. So only if lactose is present do you have the repressor bound to this allolactose and therefore keep the repressor from repressing the operon, which makes it induce the operon. Is that all clear? The thing that binds to a regulatory protein, whether it's an inducer or a repressor, the thing that binds to it is called an effector. That's EFF, not AFF. Effect is a noun, but it's also a verb, right? Well, affect is also a verb, but they mean different things. To effect means to bring about, to cause, right? Like to effect change means to bring about change. So effector molecules are the things that bind to the regulatory proteins allosterically, changing their shape so that they no longer do whatever they did. In this case, since this is a repressor, the binding of the effector to the repressor disables it as a repressor, so it no longer represses the lac operon, and that's what turns the lac operon on. All right? Everyone clear on that? Yeah.
I have one question. I get the process, right? But like, when the lactose comes in, what is the thing that actually signals
Lactose just gets isomerized into allolactose by a different enzyme. And that's only going to happen if you have lactose to begin with. And therefore, this allolactose is a signal that lactose is present because you can't make allolactose unless you have the lactose originally. Okay? So you recognize this as an inducible operon because it's normally off. It can get turned on. That's common. Operons, I said, are either inducible or repressible. The inducible ones are usually the catabolic ones. He recognizes this as a catabolic process, the processing of lactose, right? You're breaking it down to use it for energy. And it makes sense for catabolic or for a catabolic process to have an operon that is inducible, because you don't want to turn it on unless there's something to break down. On the other hand, the general scheme is for an operon to be repressible, normally on, but turn offable, if it's anabolic or synthetic. If you're building something, right, you want to build it when you don't have it. And you want to keep building it as long as the cell needs it until it starts to stockpile. When you have enough already, then that can turn it off. Does that make sense? So anabolic processes in bacteria are associated with repressible operons, whereas catabolic processes are associated with inducible operons, and that's what we're looking at for the lac operon. Well, the lac operon actually has even more exquisite control than just what I've already told you. In slide 4, we can see this. So it's not the only way it's controllable. It is definitely appropriate not to make these enzymes if there's no lactose. But what if you have lactose present and glucose present at the same time? Should you bother with the lactose? No. Right? Because you already have glucose. The reason you break down lactose is to get the glucose out of it. So if you already have glucose, why would you bother breaking down lactose to have more glucose? This would be analogous to having, you want something from a vending machine that accepts only coins. Well, if you have coins and dollar bills, why would you go to a change machine to get even more change when you already have change you can feed into the machine? Right? So, the lac operon gets turned on only when lactose is present and glucose is absent. The presence of glucose will keep the lac operon off, even if, regardless of what is happening with lactose. Glucose availability means I don't need these enzymes anyway. I'll just use the glucose I have until I run out. This shows you how this happens. It involves still another protein, abbreviated as CAP here. That stands for catabolite activating protein, or activator protein. All right. Now, a catabolite is something that is involved in a catabolic pathway. Notice that the catabolite activator protein has a binding site on it for the little circle here that represents cyclic AMP. Now, cyclic AMP is a modified version of AMP, and it's commonly used as a signaling molecule, not just here, but in many places in cells. All right? Well, there's an enzyme that's responsible for making cyclic AMP out of AMP. It's called adenyl cyclase. But anyway, if glucose is present, it interferes with the enzyme adenyl cyclase and therefore does not allow for the production of cyclic AMP. And if you don't have cyclic AMP, you don't have a CAP-CAMP complex, as it's called. The catabolite activator protein with cyclic AMP bound to it. Okay? If you do, though, have a CAP-CAMP complex, in other words, if cyclic AMP is there, it will bind to the catabolite activator protein, and you'll have the complex, which in that form will be able to bind to a place on the operon just upstream of the promoter, as you see here. Okay? Well, that, in what condition would you have the CAP-CAMP complex with respect to glucose? if there is no glucose, then you would have cyclic AMP, and therefore you would have this cap-camp complex. And as you see here, that's what allows for RNA polymerase to come down and bind to the promoter. Okay? So, if you have lactose available because of the removal of the repressor, the lac operon is technically on. But if in addition to that lactose you also have glucose, then you're not going to have any cyclic AMP, and therefore just you're going to have CAP by itself, which can't bind to this C place on the operon, and therefore, even though the operon is technically on, it's still not going to be transcribed because RNA polymerase is not going to be able to bind to the promoter. So this is an operon that has both negative and positive control, but it is an inducible operon just based on the regulatory protein and how it operates. So this ensures that the bacterium is only going to make those three proteins involved in lactose processing if lactose is there and glucose is not there. Let's go to 5 now and look at a different operon. That one was, the lac one was what? Catabolic or anabolic? Catabolic. Here we're looking at an anabolic one. And like I said, in general, anabolic operons are repressible rather than inducible. They are normally on. They can be turned off. So this one is the TRP operon, which the TRP stands for tryptophan. What is tryptophan? It's one of the biological amino acids. So important to make amino acids, right, in order to build the proteins that are required for whatever reason. Tryptophan is just one of those 20. You see the scheme of it here. Once again, it's just like in any operon. You have a promoter upstream of a promoter that gets shared by several downstream genes. Genes that code for proteins, all of which are needed at once or none of which are needed, depending on the situation. Now, it shows you all the different proteins, what their names are here. That's not really not the point here. The point is that they are all needed in the pathway. You're either going to run the pathway or not. So you either need all of them or you don't need any of them. It's the essence of an operon. But here, notice that the regulatory gene codes for a regulatory protein that operates as a repressor again and therefore can turn the operon off. But in its normal shape, without an effector also bound to it, it can't interfere with the operon. Okay? So that means even though this repressor protein exists, it's not having any effect, and therefore the operon is on. Only if the effector is present can it bind to the repressor and put it into the correct shape so that it can then repress the operon. This is the opposite situation, right? The effector before disabled the repressor, and that's what turned the operon on. Here, the repressor doesn't get activated unless the effector is present. You see the difference? And what is that repressor? Tryptophan itself. Why does this make sense? Because if there's plenty of tryptophan available, why would you bother making more? So this is the essence of an anabolic pathway. If you already have that stuff that the pathway produces, you should shut that pathway down. Now, we've talked about feedback inhibition in here already, right? If you have a biochemical pathway, then once you're no longer needing whatever that pathway produces, it starts to build up. And the appropriate thing is for that stuff that's building up to go back, to feed back and interfere with the enzyme in the pathway, the first one usually, to shut down that whole pathway so that you don't make it anymore, right? Well, that is one way of controlling how much tryptophan you would make. But this is actually going back to the drawing board, the DNA drawing board, and controlling it not at the enzyme level, but controlling it by determining whether or not those enzymes even get produced to begin with. See how that's different? Okay, so on the bottom, we can see that if tryptophan is scarce in the cell, which means the cell would need tryptophan, its scarcity means there's not going to be any tryptophan available to bind to the repressor protein. That keeps the repressor protein in a shape that does not allow it to interact with the operon, and therefore the operon gets turned on. Okay? So, or I should say, doesn't get turned off, because this is a repressible operon. It's normally on. Gets turned off if you already have made plenty of tryptophan. Now to 6. Not only do you have operons in bacteria, but another way of controlling gene expression is with messenger RNA itself. That's what we're looking at here. In some cases, the messenger RNA that's produced by transcribing a gene will be able to loop back on itself in places and one of these loops, notice there's 4 regions. If you stretch out the mRNA, it's all a sequence of nucleotides. But the yellow sequences are numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4. And 1 and 2 can fold and be complementary to each other, and so can 3 and 4. If 3 and 4 are allowed to fold the way they show you here, that operates as a terminal signal. In other words, it shuts down transcription, further transcription. Okay? Normally, when we consider a messenger RNA, we have a sequence that's upstream of the start codon for the protein, right? And that doesn't actually get translated. In this case, the upstream part actually does get translated, which is why you're making a little oligopeptide here from a ribosome. That's called the partial leader peptide, because it's transcribing this so-called leader sequence in the messenger RNA. And remember, this is a bacterium, so this can start as soon as that part of the messenger RNA is hanging off of the DNA. The rest of the messenger RNA has not yet been transcribed. But the ribosome comes along, clamps on, and makes this partial peptide. It's not really the peptide that's important here. It's the fact that the ribosome, when it gets to this first yellow section, the number 1 section, that ribosome will disallow 1 and 2 to come together and form that loop. All right? If 1 and 2 are disallowed from forming that loop, that allows 2 and 3 to actually form a loop instead. And if 2 and 3 are busy together, that means 3 and 4 can't come together. 3 and 4 are the ones that serve as a termination signal. So that means if 2 and 3 are in this configuration, then the rest of the messenger RNA can go ahead and be transcribed. This is RNA polymerase making the rest of the messenger RNA, because there isn't a termination signal. Is that clear? Okay, well, how is it that the ribosome actually causes the control? Well, in this first sequence, there's a codon for tryptophan, right? It's one of the amino acids. So codons specify amino acids, right? Well, if there is no tryptophan present, when the tryptophan codon comes up to the ribosome, or comes to the A slot of the ribosome and calls for a tryptophan carrying tRNA, there isn't going to be one, because tryptophan is not present, right? And therefore, that's going to stall the ribosome, because it has to wait for a tryptophan. By stalling there, that's what locks the 1 here so that it can't interfere with 2. That allows 2 and 3 to form the loop and disallows 3 and 4 from producing the termination signal. And therefore, transcription of the rest of the messenger RNA can proceed. On the other hand, if there is plenty of tryptophan, then the ribosome is not going to pause there, and the 1 and 2 can go back into their configuration, causing 3 and 4 to form their loop, saying to the cell, stop transcription now. Some transcription has already occurred, of course, because this is messenger RNA. It just tells the cell, don't bother transcribing the rest of the operon, the part that actually holds the codons corresponding to the genes, in other words. It just tells the transcription to turn off. And that's appropriate if you already have tryptophan, because this operon codes for the proteins necessary to produce tryptophan. Is that clear? Okay, because this stuff can drive you nuts, especially because there's double negatives a lot of times. You turn something on by turning off the fact that it's off. Okay, 7 illustrates another way in which messenger RNA can be used to control gene expression. Here you have messenger RNA looping like we did before, but for a different reason. In this case, some small molecule is able to come along and interact with the messenger RNA if it's present. And when that happens, that changes the looping. Okay? And so you can either turn a termination signal off or form one, depending on what it is there. So that's what's happening on the left half. This is transcription termination. Really happens the same exact way as the tryptophan example did in the previous one, except in this case it's not because of a ribosome pausing there. It's because of some small molecule that's either present or not, serving as the signal. All right, but it still works in the same way because it, in this case, the presence of that small molecule will change the looping so that this one serves as a termination signal, and therefore transcription gets turned off. On the other hand, it can also act as a translation switch. Translation initiation can be brought on by some small molecule binding to messenger RNA, putting it into a different looping configuration that either allows for or doesn't allow for ribosomes to bind. Only if ribosomes can bind do you have translation, right? So, in other words, you already have the messenger RNA produced here, but you don't have a protein unless you actually use that messenger RNA in translation, right? Just the fact that you have messenger RNA does not mean you have a protein yet. The messenger RNA itself can be changed by the presence of a small molecule or the absence of it into one of two configurations, only one of which allows for a ribosome to come along and translate that messenger RNA into a polypeptide. Okay? It's use of RNA as actual switches, and that's why these are called riboswitches. When messenger RNA gets looped differently, depending on the presence or absence of some other particle, these are called riboswitches. Yeah.
How do you know?
Well, this is termination of transcription. So this doesn't allow the production of the rest of that messenger RNA molecule. Just the beginning part of the messenger RNA is built, and then it tells the cell, don't transcribe the rest of that messenger RNA. In this case, the messenger RNA gets completely built, but the messenger RNA gets switched into a configuration that tells the cell, don't allow a ribosome to come along here and translate this messenger RNA. So this one is control of transcription on the left. This is control of translation, which is later. All right, that's a quick rundown of what happens in prokaryotes. Now let's turn to eukaryotes, slide 8. And, of course, gene expression is different in eukaryotes because of the fundamental differences between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. We've talked about this before, right? There is a nucleus in a eukaryotic cell, and that's where the genes are, inside the nucleus. Therefore, transcription occurs in one compartment, the nucleoplasm. The messenger RNA is built there. It gets modified, remember, unlike in prokaryotes. The pre-mRNA gets modified into mature mRNA, which then gets transported out of the nucleus to the cytosol, where translation starts, right? And Therefore, it's a little bit more complex in, just in terms of building the protein to begin with. But because of that, of those, the extra steps involved in eukaryotic gene expression, there is more opportunity to control eukaryotic gene expression, because every step in a process is a place at which you can control that process. All right? And that's why you have the five numbered items on this slide. Each one of these is a place in the process where you can control gene expression. So there, you can control it at the level of the genome, meaning the DNA itself. And we've talked about a little of this already, right? Some genes are inaccessible because they happen to be on a part of the DNA that is tightly coiled as heterochromatin, right? And so that is a form of gene expression regulation, because if you can't get to a gene, you're definitely not going to make the protein. You're not going to express that gene. But also DNA can actually be changed. We'll look at an example of that. But anything having to do directly with the DNA, that's control at the genome level. You can also control transcription itself. You know, even if a gene exists in euchromatin, meaning it's accessible for transcription, it's not tightly wound up. If it's there, it doesn't still mean that it's going to be transcribed, right? You have to have, genes are turned on and off, even if they're otherwise available for transcription. You have to have the right kinds of factors to come along and bind in order for transcription to occur, for instance. So you can definitely exercise control at the transcription level. That's what transcription factors are all about. Unless you have the right collection of transcription factors, that gene is not going to be transcribed. You can also control gene expression by RNA processing and nuclear export. Just because you transcribe a gene does not automatically mean you have the protein, like I said. If this is a eukaryote, which is what we're talking about, that messenger RNA is not ready right out of the assembly line, right? It has to be modified. So if you can interfere with that modification, that's another way of regulating gene expression. And even if you do transform it from pre-mRNA into mRNA, you still have to get it out of the nucleus. And if you can interfere with that process, that's another opportunity for controlling gene expression. All right, so that's what nuclear export's talking about. Translation is another thing that you can mess with in order to regulate gene expression. So you can bother to make the messenger RNA, you can bother to process it, bother to get it out into the cytosol, but if you interfere with the ability for a ribosome to translate that messenger RNA, then you are regulating that gene, or you're regulating the building of the protein that that gene codes for. And then finally, you can even bother to actually build the polypeptides, but a lot of polypeptides need modification after they're built in order for them to start working as whatever they're supposed to do, right? For instance, a multimeric protein needs to come together, the subunits need to come together, or some monomeric, one, a single subunit proteins need to be modified by taking some of the amino acids out of the sequence in order for it to happen. Well, that's another point at which you can control things by interfering with that process. When do we stop? Okay, I always forget that. Let's go to 9 then and look at an example of, it's an interesting example of control of gene expression at the genome level in a eukaryote. And this happens in your body. Part of your immunity consists in your ability to produce antibodies. Antibodies are proteins, immunoglobulins as they're called, that have a particular shape that recognizes some particle that's not part of you, some foreign particle that generically is called an antigen. Antibodies recognize antigens, and that serves as a signal to the cell that something is there that is not you, and therefore you should take steps to eliminate it somehow. Well, your body is able to recognize millions of different kinds of antigens. Millions of different kinds. Trillions and trillions of antigens get processed all the time. But I'm talking about millions of different kinds of antigens, which is surprising considering that you only have 20,000 genes or so, right? And we have talked about the fact that in eukaryotes, because of alternative splicing, introns and exons, a single gene can code for more than one protein. But that's not what's happening here. There aren't enough possibilities for that to account for the fact that you can make millions of different kinds of antibodies. And that has nothing to do with the majority of your genes. You have antibody genes. There aren't all that many of them. All right? What happens here is that the DNA in these antibody genes actually get changed permanently. And this is why when this happens in a cell, which is a white blood cell, white blood cells are the ones that make antibodies. When this happens in a particular white blood cell, it's a permanent change. And from then on, that white blood cell in particular is able to produce that kind of antibody and no other. And all of the cells that are its children, in a sense, its progeny cells, if that white blood cell divides and produces copies of itself, those will only be able to make that one kind of antibody. So the millions of kinds of antibodies that you're able to make comes from the fact that in each original cell, the DNA gets mixed up differently. Okay? But it's a permanent change for the lineage of that cell once it happens. Well, the gene for an antibody consists of V, D, J, and C regions. Now, the C part is a constant region, and it's not being messed with. So the C part will code for an amino acid sequence that you see on all antibodies. They all have them in common within an individual. All right? So it's the constant region because it doesn't vary from one antibody type to the other. The variable region, of course, does differ from one antibody type to the next. And the variable region gets coded for by the V, D, and J regions. Each of these, the V, the D, and the J region, have multiple subdivisions within them. It's all sequence of DNA, right? But V1, that's a stretch of DNA nucleotides within the V region. V2 is a different stretch right next to it, and so on. So there are many V regions, there are many D subregions, and many J subregions. The variability comes when the DNA gets edited permanently. So what you can think of these V, D, and J regions as being are three different decks of cards, each of which you're going to draw one card from to have a hand. Right? If you randomly draw a V, randomly draw a D, and randomly draw a J, there's many different possibilities. That's exactly what happens. Enzymatically, most of the V gets cut out, leaving a little subsegment, same thing with D and J. So in essence, you're randomly choosing one of these subsegments in V, D, and J, and you're getting a three-card hand. Well, there's thousands of possibilities for that just within this one gene because of how many Vs, Ds, and J subsegments there are. The same thing is happening with another gene because antibodies actually require two genes, two polypeptides to come together. So you really have thousands times thousands of possibilities, which is what gets you millions of overall possibilities, just for that one, well, it's two genes coding for one antibody. All right, and that just randomly happens in every lymphocyte that's born in your bone marrow. Once it happens, though, that's permanent, and therefore that cell is going to be in your blood circulating or outside in your lymph, wherever, producing its one kind of antibody. Not because it thinks you needed to. It's just totally random. And it might never encounter the right kind of antigen that it's able to recognize. So you have millions of them, all different, circulating, just a couple of them each, or one each, in your bloodstream. If you get exposed to an antigen, it eventually will happen upon that one that happens to randomly to have the right antibody, and that will tell the cell, make many copies of yourself, so now we have a hell of a lot of these antibodies that can recognize this one antigen that actually has invaded you. Okay, let's stop.